This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast. And I've tried to take Dave by surprise and it didn't work. Too bad. But hey, Dave's here. That's a good thing.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition, but everybody expects Jon to eventually start the podcast.
Hey, I did it in one go.
True. Although last time you tried to do it in two goes, and I was unwilling to comply.
Yeah, but that's normal for you. I mean, it's not like we have a master demon taking care of you. I mean, this podcast is a microservice. We have disconnected, distributed pods, containers across the oceans. Well, seas.
Well, we will be able to figure out whether we're running on VMs or bare metal coming up. So,
bare flesh, sorry.
Oh, dear. And thankfully, anyone watching on YouTube will not be seeing lots of bare flesh.
Oh, my face is bare. You want me actually to wear...
Moving on
to more interesting things. And we're doing the second half of last time's first half, which makes total sense. We're continuing to talk about Kubernetes in the Enterprise.
Indeed. So as per last time, there's only a few things in this report that are particularly, or that we thought were particularly interesting anyway. So we're skipping huge swathes of this. But, you know, if you're interested in catching up in the general state of the world and you haven't been looking at all things Kubernetes for a little while, by all means, have a look. But we're particularly focused on a few things that I would say piqued our interest.
Well, piqued your interest, perhaps. I mean, you're the Kubernetes guru here.
Yeah, and if I'm the Kubernetes guru, that tells our audience exactly how much we know, which is not very much. But
the report doesn't know all that much either sometimes to time, because we're on page 10 of the report, and if you're not on YouTube, we're showing pretty graphs. Maybe you should give YouTube a chance. But figure 8 is so telling. I mean, it explains so much. It actually shows us that people are using Kubernetes in development and production in pretty much the same amount of times.
Yeah, which is why we're not going to talk about that anymore. But what we are going to talk about is figure 9.
I do want to give the thing is that doing Kubernetes in your development environment is actually quite hard. I mean, it gives the positive things because you can easily spin up and spin down things. And on the other hand, your dev test environment does become more complicated. And if it's all running under licensed OpenShift, for example, dev test environments are typically in software world freely licensed, and with Kubernetes, I'm seeing a lot of my customers actually paying full software licenses for the infrastructure behind their dev test environments. That's not something I saw before Kubernetes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's different.
I just think the, generally speaking, like your development and test environments should always look as similar as possible to your production environments. This, to me, is thoroughly unsurprising. And it's also, much as the topic that I actually want us to get onto, this is one of those things that is, let's say, a bit vague. You know, the fact that it only calls out development or production. Like, it doesn't split that up at all. And development can mean many things to many people, but I don't want to talk about it because it's not really that interesting.
Full OTA and not the P part of it. No, it's just that people are starting to pay extra money to do the dev test because it's running in Kubernetes, which is weird that people do that, because when I was still a developer, that was totally unheard of. But things change. And apparently Dave doesn't think it's interesting, so let's move on. Spending money, Dave doesn't care.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's all that podcast money, Jon. It makes me makes me crazy with all of the riches. So no, what I do think is at least kind of interesting is figure 9, which talks about Kubernetes cluster locations, bare metal versus virtual machines. And unsurprisingly, probably, the difference between it also divides up development production. Unsurprisingly, like, it's pretty much the same, you know, in the grand scheme of things, of whether development or production. But one of the things that, again, I'm not terribly surprised about here, but again, it's a, fault might be the wrong way to put it, but it's a figment of how the data is being presented. Less than sort of less than probably 3 or 4% of people are actually using Kubernetes purely on bare metal, and something like between 60 to 65% of people are using Kubernetes purely on, and I'm going to say quote unquote, if you're watching on YouTube, you get the air quotes, virtual machines. And then sort of 25 to 30% of people are using it on a combination of both. Now, when this is talking about virtual machines, my understanding, my personal understanding of this, is that it's not just talking about virtual machines. It is collapsing both virtual machines and containerization technologies all into one thing. And I don't think that necessarily a huge proportion, although I know that there are some out there, of folks are running this purely on you know, something like a VMware ESX hypervisor and a bunch of VMs. I think this also encapsulates those that are running Kubernetes on cloud. So, Jon, I know we had a discussion around this, shall we say?
Yes, well, I still think this is a catastrophe. This is so wrong. I mean, I believe that it's true. I have no problems believing that most people are running Kubernetes on top of virtual machines, but it is such a travesty of technology here, having OS, virtual machine, container, payload. That's just so much abstraction layers, and you don't need them. And yes, there's of course the public cloud effects. If you don't have the hardware in-house, you want to put it in the on somebody else's hardware, you're kind of stuck with virtualization there. Although there are parts of the hypervisors that actually run their Kubernetes services not on VMs, but on bare metal. But it's very opaque. They don't really talk a lot about there. But and for them, of course, it doesn't matter. Because again, running Kubernetes on top of virtual machines will give you less performance, which means you'll need more CPUs, more memory, bigger cloud spend, which they have no reason, motivation to change. So why would they change it? But I mean, only like for development it's even lower, but for production 6-7% on bare metal. That is so sad. Kubernetes is built to be run on bare metal. Now, I did have a customer give me a good reason why they use it on top of virtual machines, and that was for abstraction of hardware. This customer had Kubernetes deployed on very, very, very different types of hardware, on from mini PCs to mainframe, well, not mainframes, but very big computers. And they kind of wanted to have a single deployment way, and then having a virtualization hypervisor layer in between. Well, it doesn't matter what the hardware is. Every container is being deployed on a virtual CPU of the type they choose. So it can make sense. But that's fairly exotic. Yeah, I mean, and I mean, you mentioned running on VMware clusters and things like that. I mean, why? Just set aside half of your VMware cluster, stop paying licenses to VMware, and just put Kubernetes on there.
Well, the challenge is, this isn't as widespread as it was probably only 3 or 4 years ago, but there are still a large number, and like, it is also the larger organizations, but there are a large number of folks who have and are tied into, you know, giant licensing contracts, and you know, they need to get their money's worth out of, you know, another technology, whether it's VMware or something else, and it is seen as the most expedient, efficient in air quotes, way for them to do things. Now, whether that's the reality, I think I definitely agree with you in terms of the having a wide variety of different hardware and wanting to have a more standardized experience. The other area I know that also falls into that very similar category to the one you explained is that of things like the telco world, and also a lot of the, intelligence services or military side of things, where they, telco and this sort of environments, have, generally speaking, very, very specialized hardware. It's very different from the consumer grade hardware that you would see normally, for a wide variety of different reasons that I won't go into, but having a standardized layer that can go on top of them and provide a standard looking, feeling, smelling, tasting experience for their automation is, again, something that makes a huge amount of sense. So we see it in that space as well, for sure. I just think this is, again, we have different areas of focus between Jan and myself, should we say. And, you know, I see a lot of organizations running Kubernetes in the cloud and just not even batting an eyelid about it. Like, that's just what they do. It's just how they do it. And it is what it is.
Yes. And then, as we saw last time, they complain about how hard it is to tune the environment. What the hell are you expecting? Keep calm, keep calm. I mean, if this thing,
I think we'd better move on before
Jan. Your application is running slowly. It could be the application, it could be the Kubernetes layer, it could be the virtualization layer, it could be the hardware layer, and none of these layers, well, depending, maybe the application layer is simple, but the other layers are all very complex. So how do you expect to be able to actually performance tune something in a reliable way, in a replicatable way, if you put so much abstraction in between? And that's kind of,
I hear you.
Again, I'm happy that my customer set that I talk most about, public sector, they aren't allowed to go to cloud yet for a lot of their stuff. So they are very eager to put this stuff in place in their own environments, but yeah, they're still using VMware. And I'm trying, and I'm preaching here. What can I do to change the world, to make the world a better place? Come on, help me.
Well, the thing that you can do, Jan, is the thing you can do is you can educate the final 10% of, between 7 and 10% of people who answered this question of where does your Kubernetes environment run, bare metal VMs or both, with, I don't know. And this, to me, I think is a little bit disappointing. To say the least. But it does also, like, you could paint it differently. Like, to me, this is disappointing. But I know that my background is infrastructure, and like, I have an infrastructure focus. I always will do. Like, it's what I grew up doing. It's kind of my formative experiences, should we say. But so, you know, when people say, oh, I don't even know what environment this is running on, to me, that's a little bit disappointing. But what it does also suggest is how good the experience has got for developers, that they don't need to know. Like, they just, all they need to know is that they deploy on this thing and this thing does its magic. And maybe that's kind of wonderful. And I can see Jan is unconvinced.
I've got a positive and a negative vibe on this.
Okay. I
mean, the positive vibe is that these I don't knows are used. These are the companies that are so deep into the multi-cloud, hybrid cloud, and whatever they're running, it just fixes itself and starts itself, whatever it needs to be. So they actually can't tell. It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You can know if it's running, but not where it's running. So let's add some quantum mechanics in here. But no, considering that this survey was sent specifically to people that are in the Kubernetes crowd, this wasn't sent to everybody. They actually curated mm-hmm. their target audience to be the Kubernetes users. And if the developer doesn't know where the production runs, yeah, I can get that. But as a developer, not knowing where you are developing.
Again. Development here is used as an umbrella term. Like, would anyone necessarily know where it's from? I'm trying to be nice here. But let's move on from this disastrous graph
to a more disastrous one.
I don't know if this one is more disastrous.
Yes, it is.
This one to me is... Oh, this is interesting, because I just think this is, well, duh, of course. But maybe yes, you have a different take on it. Okay. So we're talking about workloads run on Kubernetes clusters. And the reason I think that this is, well, duh, of course, is that over 90% of workloads are web apps, according to this sort of, or 90% of people are running web app applications on a Kubernetes cluster, which to me makes total sense. Like, they're typically distributed microservices apps that like scale nicely and linearly, and you can break them all out and scale little bits differently, and it's perfectly designed for the kind of magic that Kubernetes provides. So no surprise, it's the largest category. Wahey.
And that's it. That's the only takeaway you have from here. I mean,
I don't find anything else there particularly interesting, because everything else is like between 10% and 40% of people are running other stuff, which again, like, of course, like people will run all sorts of stuff. But
how can in a stateless environment, which mm-hmm. Kubernetes is supposed to be, there is more database storage intensive than CPU and GPU intensive, even memory intensive? The whole idea of Kubernetes is these microservices, those web apps, those are running in Kubernetes. But please don't tell me you're running your SQL, Postgres, whatever database on your Kubernetes environment.
Well, again, this is a, in my opinion, poorly written / provided graph, because that to me also makes perfect sense. And it's not that just because the database workload is running on Kubernetes, that doesn't necessarily mean that the data or the storage intensive workload is running on Kubernetes. It doesn't mean the data is living there. That's why there are things like S3 object stores and GCS and all of these other cloud native storage platforms.
Yeah, you're trying to skewed what you're seeing. It says here 50% storage database intensive. And mm-hmm. I mean, if the data isn't stored there, then it's not a storage intensive workload. And again, you're not going to run your compute for your SQL on a Kubernetes cluster with remotely attached disks. That makes no sense.
But that's your that's why I'm saying that this is a poorly written design questionnaire / graph, because that's my interpretation of it, which to me makes perfect sense. But your interpretation is very different, because you interpret it a different way. And I just...
Yeah, I do it the right way. I'm surprised that CPU is so low still. I would kind of think that, I mean, Kubernetes, one of the advantages that you can spin up what you need when you need it and spin it down very quickly when you don't need it. GPU, VMs with GPUs are the most expensive ones out there. And typically, it's been a while, but I don't think they're that prevalent, available in Kubernetes services. Typically, you find a lot of memory and CPU intensive, but I guess CPUs, with certainly the AI hype, it must be available there too. And again, with the Gen AI stuff, having a natural language processing thing behind your search bar for your website, for example, that's a very expensive layer because you kind of want to have some GPUs in there. And yes, most machine learning things are trained on GPU and running on CPU, but for the NLP things, the LLM things, there's definite advantages to running them on GPU. There's a big speed difference there. And well, maybe this is too old because, again, this has come out in 2023, end of 2023. That's just before the hype all started, considering that this probably was sent out even at least 6 months before that.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see next year to do the same thing maybe again, if there's a big spike there on GPUs. I would kind of expect it, actually.
Maybe. I mean, the reason that I say at most maybe on this is I know that everyone is talking about this, but the number of organizations globally, the masses out there that are actually doing this type of stuff for themselves and not just, you know, consuming someone else's service, consuming someone else's model, etc., I think is still of this order of magnitude. Like, I genuinely don't think that that many organizations, like, again, I get it, everyone is talking about it, everybody wants to do it, but most organizations are consuming someone else's platform, someone else's SaaS platform to be able to provide this kind of service. They're not building it themselves, they're not running it themselves on their own Kubernetes. And I think this just reflects that. And I hope that will shift over time. You know I do. You know I'm a huge fan of open source technology. And my fervent wish is that you know, it will become stronger and stronger. And we've seen some signs of that from our conversations we've had with our good friends on all things LLM. But I still think this is very, very accurately reflective of the current state of the nation as it exists today for the wider masses.
And would you expect a bump for next year? Or the same?
I think the same. It might be a slight increase, but again, like, most people are consuming other services to provide this kind of solution. And I think the folks that are using GPU intensive workloads back in, you know, let's say early to mid 2023 when this survey data was done, like, I don't imagine that will have changed by the time this is run again. Not really.
I could expect more test development projects being spun up to try stuff out, and those are typically run in Kubernetes because it's cheap and easy and quick and dirty.
I don't know.
It'll be incremental at most.
Yeah, I think so.
I just hope that the storage database intensive bar goes down by a lot. I'm not going to say you're doing it the wrong people, but...
Oh, dear me. Well, on that note, before Jan has an aneurysm, anything else from you, Jan?
No, I'm going to go to my Zen corner now.
All right. Well, while Jan is raking his little swirly patterns in his desk garden, that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. We are on YouTube. You can like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, comment, all the YouTube things. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page. And for more information about the podcast, send your feedback to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Until next time, my name is, giving the benefit of the doubt, Dave.
And my name is, soon to be on life support, Jon.
We look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then.